'em all, E. McGuire's. They're drinkers, they're liars, but they're men. Make way for 'em all, E. McGuire's. You'll never see the likes of them again. Down the mines, though sunlight shines, the pit's as black as hell. Mud and slime, they do their time, it's Paddy's prison cell. And they curse the day they traveled far, and drown their tears in a jar. So make way for the Molly Maguires, they're drinkers, they're liars, but they're men.
The trials of the Molly Maguires resulted in the largest act of mass execution in American history. It was a calculated genocide directed toward Irish Catholic immigrants at a time that it was fashionable politically and socially in this country to be anti-Catholic. The Know Nothing Party was an official political party in the United States. There were riots in the late 1840s and 1850s in Philadelphia, which burned, among other things, St. Augustine's Church right down the street here. It was a time when there was no anti-discrimination, no fair employment legislation, and the Irish who were in Pennsylvania came here and were exploited in various types of hard labor, the mines being one of them.
They were the earliest leaders of the labor movement of America. They were the original leaders of the American. Out of the Molly Maguires came Johnny Mitchell, who was an Irish from Ireland, who led the mine workers, who established the mine workers. And then out of that came John L. Lewis. And all these people, Bill Green came from the miners, all these people who lead and established the labor movement in America were an offspring of those people.
When the wind blows wild and wide at the break of melancholy, if you stand in the dark with your ears to the wind, you can hear the sons of Molly. Deep in the dark of the owl mine shaft, you can smell the smoke and the fire, and the whisper low in the mines below, it's the ghost of Molly Maguire.
Whether there ever was an authentic Molly Maguire who gave her name to the activists of the Pennsylvania coalfields 100 years ago is a matter of much doubt. But the Mollies do have a connection with the ribbon men of the early part of the last century, and with the secret societies which sprang from them on the other side of the Atlantic. Sean Cronin of New York has done a great deal of research on this period of American history.
I read up as much as I could, and I found that most accounts were hostile. They were regarded as killers, murderers, terrorists, and so on. And even the Irish, you could find out very, very little, because the Molly Maguires, as it turned out, were miners, and the only organization at that time that the Irish immigrant used was the Ancient Order Hibernians. When they came here, the immigrant would join an ancient order of Hibernian Lodge. And in fact, this great conspiracy in eastern Pennsylvania called the Molly Maguires was totally permeated through and through with the AOH, which was often called the Mollies, and was made to appear as some sort of a conspiracy. When I would go to libraries in these small mining towns. And usually, it seems to me the population changed after what happened to the Molly Maguires. These mine owners had to get labor, and they usually went to Europe for that labor, and they imported them a great number of Slovaks, Poles, I think, and perhaps some Germans. At any rate, the people, the descendants of these people, had a fearful idea of what the Molly Maguires were all about. And you could not find in a library any accounts. And American libraries, I have to point out, are very thorough. If anything happened in a town, and if a book has been published, they go out of their way. They are professional librarians, and they go to enormous extent of cost and so on to get these books. Yet nothing on the Mollies existed. And when I went to one library, the librarian said to me, if we had anything, it would not be in the history section, it would be in the crime section. And then I talked to a professor at a university man who lived in his father, he was a coal miner's son, and he lived in the coal mining shack that he had grown up in, but he had changed the insides, made it a summer home and so on. And we had a long conversation about it. And he told me that his understanding was that many of the Irish had been driven out of the eastern Pennsylvania after the hangings. Remember, there were 20 Irish. I often consider this a remarkable thing. If you add up the number that were executed by Britain in the 19th century in Ireland, apart from Robert Emmet's rebellion, it was not a great number until you come to the Manchester Martyrs and a few others. But at one, in 2-year period in America, the land of opportunity for the Irish, 20 Irish were hanged. And evidence that we now know was largely falsified. I'm not saying everybody maybe didn't deserve. I'm not a judge. But quite clearly, this was an extraordinary occurrence.
It's impossible to fully comprehend and understand the Molly Maguire trials unless you understand a little bit about the political and social climate at that time. There was an election in Pennsylvania in 1875 for governor of Pennsylvania. The candidate of the Democratic Party was an anti-labor, anti-Catholic, anti-black judge by the name of Cyrus Pershing, who had a very undistinguished term in the state legislature. Cyrus Pershing voted against President Lincoln's freeing of the slaves. He voted against the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, very basic due process cornerstones in our system of jurisprudence in this country. Judge Pershing was an anti-labor judge. He ran for governor in 1875 as the handpicked candidate of the mining and railroad interests. The Irish miners, who were usually Democrats, voted Republican in that election, and Pershing lost the election by 10,000 votes. It would be unheard of today and unthinkable for a judge like Pershing to then subsequently preside over the trials of the miners, which he did. Pershing was the judge who presided over these trials. These were kangaroo trials. They created a special judicial district. Instead of just picking the jurors from Schuylkill County or from the other counties where the alleged incidents took place, they grafted onto Schuylkill County a special judicial district which included Schuylkill County plus Lebanon County. Lebanon County is a county in Pennsylvania which is predominantly, even till this day, German. Many of the jurors, all the jurors, were selected from areas which had an anti-Catholic bias. All Catholic names and all Irish names were stricken from the list of the jurors. Many of the jurors were not citizens. Some of the jurors could not speak English. Indeed, there was a juror by the name of Levi Stein who asked the, right in the court record, asked the prosecutor if he could go slow and speak in German because he couldn't understand English. This is the type of jury they wanted. It was a hanging jury. The fate of the miners was preordained even before the trials. The trials were merely public relations strategies to really clean up the dirty work, namely the hanging of the miners and the breaking of the strike.
John Elliott, the Philadelphia attorney who last year obtained a full posthumous pardon for the leader of the Molly Maguires, Black Jack Kehoe. Also from Philadelphia is John Morris, grandson of a convicted Molly, now business manager of a big Teamster union representing industrial workers and public employees.
My father's family were 12, and his father was a mine worker who attempted to organize mine workers back in 1870 and under terrible conditions of poverty and sickness and exploitation by the mine owners and railroads. And as a result of their effort to try to uplift them in the standard of living, they were tagged at that particular time. Our government didn't protect workers. They considered any kind of a meeting of a worker at that time a conspiracy against the government. and the mine owners were allowed to hire their own private army, their own police force. They exploited the worker, and as a result, the miners get into a secret organization, and they call themselves the Molly Maguires. And in their effort to increase their standard of living and their help, they went against the greatest forces of this country. At no time in America was there ever a civilian court trial that resulted in the hanging of 19 miners.
The man who was chief mine owner was a man named Francis B. Gowan. Gowan's people came from the north of Ireland, and he knew a great deal about the ribbon organizations of the Irish countryside. And Gowan was the man who hired McParlin. Gowan was also the district attorney for Schuylkill County, which is one of the counties in eastern Pennsylvania, and as well as being a mine owner and a financier. And furthermore, he was the leading Democratic politician in eastern Pennsylvania. And he was challenged, and this seems to me to be the theory behind the thing. He was challenged on two levels. In the 1870s in America, there was a vast depression. And the great boom of the Civil War period was ending. So they wanted to cut down miners' wages. There were strikes all over. The Irish miners organized themselves as a secret organization. Gowan wanted to smash it and drive them out, and he hired the Pinkertons for that purpose. The second thing was that financially, his company itself was in danger. He had built up not merely the mines, but the rails that ran the coal into New York and into the markets. And his entire financial thing was teetering. His shareholders were largely English. So you had a combination transferred to the New World of the struggle in the Old World in Ireland, of the landlords and of the English and so on and so forth. And in effect, that's the way it seemed to come out. In American politics, he was being challenged by Kehoe, Jack Kehoe, who was called colloquially the King of the Mollies. He was a leading AOH man. He had been a miner. He bought a tavern in 1861. And eventually Gowan wanted Kehoe. He wanted to have him executed. And McParlin, they were able to work it, that he was charged with a debt for which somebody else, in fact, I think, had been convicted. Or there was this man had died after a beating. He was a coal boss who was responsible for the peace raids.
The murder of the unpopular mine foreman Frank W. Langdon, for which Kehoe was hanged in 1878, had occurred in 1862. In the years between, there were numerous other acts of violence, directed mostly against mine superintendents and the heavies they employed to intimidate the Irish workers. John Morris again.
Well, my grandfather was charged with shooting a person called Bully Bull Thomas. He was a professional fighter. He came from Welsh background. His job was, it appeared very definite, was to beat up on the Irish peasants for the mine owners. And as a result of beating up on the peasants, he did that three or four times a week in the center of the town and terrorized them. And my grandfather, John Morris, a young man named John Hurley, and a young fellow named Mike Doyle, and another miner named John Gibbons, was charged with attempt murder of Bully Bull Thomas. And they were charged with attempting to kill him in a mule stable. They later were identified by Thomas and other people. The week of the period when they were being tried, Thomas killed a waitress. Thomas was instrumental in killing a young girl named, was married to Friday O'Donnell. Thomas had a whole history of violence, a thug, and he was the coal company's thug and the likes of him. And they had a group in that town that they called the Murdochs. They were Pennsylvania Dutch and partly Protestant background. And these group, this Murdoch group, was siding with Thomas, a Welsh. And they used to bring as much violence on the Irish miners as they could bear. It got to the point where the mine workers and could no longer bear the kind of violence that he was bringing on them, and they made plans to stop him. And that is where it came into play, where my grandfather was charged in attempted murder of Bully Bull Thomas. There were four other mine workers with him who were charged with it. He was charged with a conspiracy to kill Thomas. He was convicted and sent to prison. And I'd like to point out again that while they were being tried, they ran their coffins through towns. Nobody at all were allowed to associate with them. The miners that were hung, their graves had no identification because they were not allowed to have any identification. They were buried away from their homes. During the process of the trial of my grandfather, as the records will indicate, that seven around the jury couldn't speak English, didn't know what was going on, and he had no money. The trial was just shammed through, quickly tried and convicted.
If the Molly Maguires were pretty ruthless in disposing of their enemies, the mine bosses and the Pinkerton Detective Agency certainly had their own ideas about ensuring law and order. A well-organized vengeance killing involving, in particular, the O'Donnell family living near Mahanoy City took place in 1875. Joe Wayne from Girardville.
We're in a little village called Wigans, W-E-I-G-A-N-S Patch, which is very historical during the Molly Maguire era, because here took place the infamous Wigans Massacre, where Jackie Ho's brother-in-law, Charles O'Donnell, 18 years of age, and his sister-in-law, Ellen O'Donnell McAllister, who was 21 years of age and pregnant, were slaughtered. He also had his mother-in-law, Granny O'Donnell, pistol-whipped by a vigilante group known as the MODOCs, M-O-D-O-C-S. That is a group which you very seldom see referenced by any of the authors of the Molly Maguire era, and very little work has ever been done to try to find out just who was behind it, except the fact that it was often referenced to as a Welsh vigilante group. What took place here in a home on your left is it's a double home, a company home erected by the various coal companies to house their employees. They rented the homes themselves on for $1 a month and were subject to the whims of the company. If they should step out of line, they could be evicted at a moment's notice. On the left side was the O'Donnell family. On the right side was the McAllister. Ellen O'Donnell married James McAllister. One particular evening, there was a commotion on the bottom floor, which aroused the inhabitants. James McAllister informed his wife to stay where she was till he went down to find out what the noise was about. When he didn't return immediately, she came down the steps and apparently frightened one of the vigilante members, who turned around and fired a bullet right into her stomach, killing she and the baby she was carrying. The braid she was wearing caught on a nail on the wall, and she was suspended in somewhat of a grotesque fashion, which is how she was found in by her mother. When she ripped the mask off the fellow and identified him as their butcher by the name of Wendrick, W-E-I-N-R-I-C-H, she asked Butcher Wendrick, "How could you?" And before he could even reply, a fellow pointed a gun at her and was apparently ready to shoot her down when someone said, "We don't shoot women." They pushed the gun aside, but the fellow still was intent to do damage, and he pistol-whipped her across the face, knocking her to the floor. During the ensuing melee, you had James McAllister, who was apprehended by the vigilantes and had a rope around his neck, a boarder who was unknown who stayed in the premise at the time and was apparently let go because he was identified as not being wanted, and you had Charles O'Donnell, the young man who was killed. McAllister made a break for the front door and we later found was shot in the right arm, as was reported in the local paper, the Shenandoah Herald, as he was treated by a doctor in Mahanoy City. Young Charles O'Donnell was shot in the chest. Charles ran towards what they described as a Pollock's house, which you can see on the right, another company home, in the dead of night. They didn't know if it was Charles O'Donnell or James Friday O'Donnell that they wounded. But to make sure that they completed their task, they ran after him and fired 15 more bullets at point-blank range into the body, which ignited the bedclothing he was wearing. The body was almost burnt beyond recognition.
and was finally identified by Kehoe when he came to the house and asked what happened. When Kehoe realized what group was behind this, he told the family to say no more about it, he would handle it. The story that we are told by our family was that Kehoe was afraid that they were trying to extract an eye for an eye, and eventually they would wipe out any opposition they had to the Cold Barons themselves. So nothing ever really came of the fact that the two people and the unborn child were murdered. No one was ever brought to trial, and no one ever did anything as far as Butcher Wendrick was concerned.
My grandfather was born in America, but his father was born in Mayo, in Ireland. And they came to America, and they settled in a little town called Jenkintown, right outside of Wilkes-Barre, PA, and they became miners. And it was considered at that particular time, if you supported the mine workers and you supported, at that time, most of your union people were Irish. Most of your union leaders at that time were Irish. And it was a great hardship that was on the miners in those years. The mine company owned their house. The mine company paid their salary in mine money. They call it strip, company money. The mine company owned the store. You had to buy your clothes and everything from the mine company. And after you paid the mine company off, you had nothing. You had to buy your equipment, your tools. And it was just the worst exploitation, that one of the worst that the history of this government. And they did it in a secret manner, try to prevent and try to organize against the railroads and the mine companies. And as a result of that, the powerful railroads and the powerful mine companies discredit them. And the way they said they were terrorists, they were involved in violence, and they were involved in all these things. But the real violence was against the worker. The worst violence was the silent violence of poverty and sickness and exploitation that their children, my grandfather, my father, as I said, came from a family of 12. He was taken out of his home when he was only 9 years old and put on a slate bank.
And what's a slate bank?
That's to pick the slate off the coal. And young boys between 7, and this is not exaggeration, 7 to maybe 12 years old were put on slate banks, and they were called breaker boys and slate pickers. And as you can see, I have a hand that's 4 fingers off. My father's hand was badly damaged on the slate bank. There were no gloves. They had no anything to cover their hands, and their hands were badly cut. As a result of those years of the tremendous, fierce propaganda against the mine workers and the Molly Maguires, that it was almost unheard of if you would associate. But over the years, I always felt, and my brothers and everybody else, that it was a proud thing that our grandfather was a Molly Maguire. We considered him in the same fashion. He was convicted, tried with the rest of them, and he was sentenced to prison for 7 years, and he done 7 years. He came out of prison half blinded. He came out of prison, and the mine workers, who were again Irish, they gathered together their strength politically, and through their collective strength politically and their background being Irish, they made him a county judge. He couldn't read or write, but anybody with the name with a Welsh background or had a Welsh name like Davis, Davy Davis or Eddie Edwards or Willie Williams, all those kind of people seemed to take sides. They were the mine bosses. The Welsh owned the mines, the English owned the mines, and the Irish were the laborers.
My great-grandfather was John Jack Kehoe, who was legally murdered by the combination of the coal interest and the Pinkerton detectives and the coal and iron police for a crime he never committed on December 18th of 1878. I should say he was hanged on December 18th of 1878 for a crime that had taken place over 16 years before, back in 1862. Even though he had produced evidence that he was nowhere near the scene, and other people admitted being involved in the conspiracy and the plot to actually throw stones and eventually beat with a swingle tree, which is a form of a branch of a tree, one Franklin Langdon, and that the actual murderer had confessed to it, the authorities refused to admit the testimony and did not make the people who had the evidence available. So that there was a contrived plot to get rid of Mr. Kehoe, only for the simple reason that It was a labor union which he was involved in, and as made known later on and many years later by Franklin Gowan, the head of the coal interest, they spent over $4 million, which if you can fathom what that amount of money would be today, when you're talking in the area of 1862 to 1878, to break up what he considered to be one of the most unscrupulous labor unions and trade unions in the United States. So we fortunately have been able to prove 100 years later the innocence of Jack Kehoe, and I'm sure we eventually will prove the innocence of many of the other 19 men who were hanged.
The alleged leader of the Molly Maguires was John Kehoe, who was a native of County Wexford or Wicklow. I don't recall which, but Kehoe was a very substantial person. He was the Democratic High Constable of Girardville. He was a leader in the Working Men's Benevolent Association, which was the precursor of the Knights of Labor, which was the precursor of the United Mine Workers. He was a very strong and effective person, and he was the person that the mine interests knew they had to remove. Now, it wasn't bad enough that they rigged the juries, that they changed the law to change the area from which the jurors were selected, that they systematically excluded Catholics from the jury, and that they handpicked the judge, who was a political opponent of the miners, to preside over the trials. They also allowed a man by the name of Benjamin Franklin Gowan, who was an Orangeman, to act as special prosecutor. Gowan was the president of the Reading Coal and Iron Company. Gowan himself tried the cases against the miners. He was assisted by a gentleman by the name of General Albright, who wore his full military uniform during the trials. He wore the uniform to suggest to the jurors that he was the true America, that he was the true sense of justice, and that these Irish were radical ragamuffins that had a dance at the end of a rope. It's a very sorry page in Pennsylvania history. It has unfortunately not been fully scrutinized until now, because the Irish at that time were absolutely aghast at the magnitude of the brutality. I mean, it made Cromwell look like a generous spirit. An examination of the court records today shows overwhelming evidence that would exonerate Kehoe. However, when people attempted to testify and offer character witnesses or offer any type of evidence on behalf of the miners, they were fired from their jobs in the mine. They were blacklisted. They were cut off at the company store. They were actually evicted from the company homes. And some of them, including an 18-year-old girl and a woman in her 20s, were actually taken from the one courtroom where they attempted to testify, immediately taken to another courtroom, convicted of perjury by the same type of kangaroo court, and put in the Pottsville prison. Now, that is the type, and all the time these trials were going on, the National Guard was outside, thousands of soldiers. The National Guard had been used in Pennsylvania as a strike-breaking mechanism through the 1930s.
In Girardville, Hibernian House, the pub owned by Black Jack Kehoe, is now in the possession of his great-grandson, Joe Wayne. Joe is special assistant to the state treasurer of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania in Harrisburg, and town chairman of his local borough in the Democratic Party interest. In Hibernian House, he showed us numerous photographs and mementos of Black Jack, and he brought us to many of the places associated with his great-grandfather and the other Molly Maguires.
We're now standing at the gravesite and the monument to my great-grandfather, John Jack Kehoe, from County Wicklow, died December 18th of 1878, I should say legally murdered, age 41 years, 5 months, and 15 days. He's buried here with his wife, Mary Ann Kehoe, who succeeded him in death 9 years later. Or 7 years later, I'm sorry, my math is getting bad.
1885.
Yes, 7 years.
And the stone has been redone recently,
The stone was knocked off its moorings, and we recently, through the efforts of Charles McCarthy, who was a historian who wrote the book The Great Molly Maguire Hoax, whereby he took the stand that Kehoe is an innocent man based on information he had gathered and what the family had given, and through the efforts of my uncle, Jack McDonald, my mother's brother, and a grandson of Jack Kehoe, and they made arrangements to clear out the cemetery, and I might say they did an excellent job. It was all overgrown. Great deal of tourism here now to finally paying tribute to the men of a labor movement. But I did remark earlier that I thought I should say again here, but, Frank, is the fact that this is the first time I visited the grave since I was successful in obtaining the pardon and the Declaration of Innocence by the Honorable Governor Milton Shapiro in January of 79. And somewhat of a moving experience.
In the same cemetery in Tamaqua are the graves of Charles and Ellen O'Donnell, victims of the Wigan's Patch Massacre, of Joe Wayne's great-great-grandfather, Manus O'Donnell, from the parish of Doe in County Donegal, and of two Campbells from Glenties, Alexander and John, both convicted mollies. Alexander, in fact, having been hanged in 1877 for his part in the murder of Mine Superintendent John P. Jones in 1875.
We're presently at the marker for the Campbell family, and this is where it is believed that Alex Campbell, who was also hanged, is buried. You'll notice there are no names referencing the fact that he is here, but historically he was supposed to put in a grave where they didn't mark it. It was questionable as to whether or not some of these gentlemen were even buried on consecrated ground because of the church's attitude that they were excommunicated for belonging to a secret society. He had a brother also, John Campbell, who was charged, and an attorney brother by the name of Anthony Campbell, who had represented him.
About 20 miles from Tamaqua is Pottsville Jail, where the Molly Maguire prisoners were confined. The small, dark, vaulted cells in which they awaited trial or execution or long-term sentences are still to be seen.
Supposedly these were the two cells that were the Molly Maguires were kept in. These cells originally are used for disciplinary cells. And a person that was found to be a problem in the prison or caused trouble, they were usually shackled to the floor here. And as you can see, there's four shackles. They were shackled face down on the floor. There were no beds in the cells at all. They laid straw on the floor, and that's where they were kept all day long.
Obviously, the arms would be pretty far apart.
Right, they were shackled face down on the floor. And there were four to a cell at this time. Basically, the cell is there's one small window in it for the light. That was what light came in. There were no lights at this time. Also, there was no heat.
No toilet facility.
When a person had to go, when an inmate had to go to the bathroom, there were two troughs on both sides of the cell, and there was running water. And as they went to the bathroom, you know, the water ran along these
troughs.
There's
here.
Two channels here,
let me,
right?
Let me explain something in here, if I may. When Kehoe's wife and family would come down to see him, they did have at that time, I believe, they brought a cot in for them. He was held in here from the time he was initially tried back on June 16th of 1877 for something like a year before that. He was initially arrested along with John Morris's grandfather for an atrocious assault with intent to kill on William Thomas, alias Bully Bill Thomas. That was another questionable charge, which subsequently we find no fruit to it. But when he was initially brought in here, they did shackle him, but they didn't have him face down. He was given a break. He wasn't here to be penalized for a disruption of anything, but they did have shackles around his legs and around his hands with chains running through the bolts on the floor itself. Mike mentioned the fact that the only light you had was from a small window in the rear of the cell. You had no heat, you had no light, you had no toilet facilities whatsoever, and you had very few visitors.
I am Richard Russell. I'm the district attorney of Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania. Last fall, after the petition was filed on behalf of Jack Kehoe for his post-death pardon, I was asked to give an opinion to the Board of Pardons. At that time, I didn't realize that the record of the case was available. This is the transcription of the case was available. And after I received that letter, I inquired of our clerk of courts and then found that the original record of the trial, the original transcript, was still available. So I obtained it and read it. and was surprised at some of the rulings, etc., in the case. But there was no doubt in my mind that the evidence of the Commonwealth was shaky at best, and certainly if similar type evidence had been given to me to arrest a man for murder today, I would never do it.
They were presently in courtroom number one of the Schuylkill County Courthouse in Pottsville, Pennsylvania, overlooking the rear entrance into the Schuylkill County Prison, where we just visited Jack Kehoe and the other Molly Maguire's cells in the dungeons. From the vantage point we have here, you are taking the same view that the juries would have had when they would stop a trial and remark about the number of Molly Maguire's being brought to justice, and they would purposely parade men shackled together in and out those doors with the intent of prejudicing the mind of the juries, that the complete roundup of this illegal organization was taking place. Now, in the front of the room, you could see the, if you remember seeing any paintings or pictures in the various books you have read, that is where the Pinkerton detective would sit there with his foot up on the railing as he testified, and my great-grandfather would be in the forefront while on trial.
It still be the same layout, more or less, as is today.
Yes, except for modern furnishings, the new carpeting and so forth, which I might add is attributable to the Democratic administration of 1975.
which we have around us here.
Yes, we're standing here also right now with the Honorable Joseph Lynch, Record of Deeds, and Honorable John Flannery, the Register of Wills of Schuylkill County, former running mates of mine, and hopefully both will be elected to their respective positions, Mr. Lynch against the Recorder of Deeds and Mr. Flannery to the County Commissioner seat, for not one term, but at least two anyhow.
Well, this is a complete reversal of the history of 100 years ago almost.
I'll tell you how much of a reversal it was. In February 18th of 1975, I was sworn in as County Controller in the same courtroom. I stood in virtually the same spot as my great-grandfather stood 100 years ago when he was found guilty of murder in the first degree of Franklin Langdon. The ironies, not only of the fact that I was in the same courtroom being appointed to a respective position in the county government, but also the fact that the judges sat in bank because of the historical occasion, in that the president judge of the Court of Common Pleas was one James J. Kern, Sr., the chairman of the board of the Reading Coal Company, and 100 years ago, it was the Reading Coal Company through the president, Franklin Gowan, who prosecuted, or I should say persecuted, my great-grandfather and legally murdered him.
There's a large amount of literature available now on the Molly Maguires, much of it based on the reports of the Pinkerton detective, James McParlin, who infiltrated the organization and seems indeed to have been actively involved as agent provocateur in some of the crimes alleged against the Mollies. But the whole sordid episode has also provided material for fiction and for a film made 10 years ago.
I had read the books of John O'Hara, in which there are many references to the Mollies. One got a great sense of it, and I ran into the descendants of many of these people, who in one case a town clerk, in another case a policeman, who had a knowledge, and they were waiting for something to happen. And what did happen was that film that was made by Martin Ritt, which was not a bad film, except that the hero emerges as Richard Harris, who was the Pinkerton agent, a man named McParlin from South Armagh, although in South Armagh they say he wasn't, that he was from Liverpool, but wherever he was from, he was the man who broke up the alleged Molly conspiracy. He had a vested interest in the conspiracy. He engaged in some of the killings that took place, quite clearly, and by sheer accident I ran into his career again in the famous American labor trial of Big Bill Haywood, Western Federation of Miners, who was defended by Clarence Darrow. And lo and behold, the man who worked this court case so that the prosecution would send Haywood to the gallows with two of his colleagues was our friend McParlin. And in this case, he was up against Clarence Darrow, who broke down the witnesses. But it was the same pattern as the Molly Maguires, which would lead one to believe that certainly much the same type of lying and perjury and other things took place.
As might be expected in view of their own ruthless methods and the weight of the propaganda machine ranged against them, the Molly Maguires have not had in the past what might be called a very good press. But in recent years, all that has changed. and particularly since the posthumous pardon for Black Jack Kehoe, one senses in America now a tendency to speak of them even with pride rather than apology.
Well, my grandfather was a miner all his life. The only time he ever saw his father was in the coffin. His father starved to death in a mine accident at a big mine run in the late 1880s. My mother's people were miners. They, I really have taken a great deal of gratification from this because all I've been doing, frankly, at a different level is continuing the same fight for social justice and for fairness that they began under much less favorable circumstances 100 years ago. Now, these people who were involved in attempting to organize the Working Men's Benevolent Association and who continued to fight for social justice in the coal mines were really the martyrs of labor. They performed a tremendous task. I only hope that the social conscience at the bar, in the universities, in the media, is beginning to focus on these injustices. Unfortunately, the Irish have always been an expendable people, and we just never had the opportunity to have the academic institutions, the media, and what have you bring the same sense of the same quest for social justice to this that they did to other minorities. And I think that maybe that tide has turned, and this is going to be looked at much more objectively and scholarly.
I often feel, you know, all these little people that had to emigrate from Ireland, that really had no choice, that had to get out, and then what they met in the New World when they went into the hostility and discrimination, that something really is necessary to stand up 100 years afterwards and say that these people not only spoke for their own people, but they spoke for labor in general, which absolutely had no rights, because labor in this country was considered emigrant, and they should be down on their knees every day for giving them the right to be in the country. So they were exploited, something fierce. And I think, as an Irishman, I'm always happy to think that the Molly Maguires stood up and suffered for it.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.